the talk on from the view of an external scholar, reaction to the global health recommendations of the Office of Research and Women's Health Strategic Plan by Dr. Marcia Bain-Smith fits right in for the other perspective. So there's the academic critique of how science and our operationalization of science with all its judgments that we've just discussed moves us in some direction. And then there's sort of the community and participatory approach that and how you actually sustain change and ensure that the appropriate groups are working on it together. So I think the perspectives are just really phenomenal to get at a lot of the issues that are important. Dr. Bain-Smith is associate professor of urban studies in the Urban Studies Department at Queens College, City University of New York, and a member of the faculty of the Department of Preventive Medicine at SUNY Hospital in Downstate. She's conducted community and population-based research in the past 25 years, has published extensively on health issues of women, immigrants, and racial ethnic minorities. Dr. Bain-Smith basically examined the status of post-1965 Afro-Caribbean diaspora in New York and is a founding member of the Caribbean Women's Health Association. And she's gone on to be the president and later the board of this organization and helped make it, together with the health agency, it's enough, but just this is really, really amazing to really be able to create a community organization with a health institution that can actually address the needs of people in the area. So you have a great perspective. Thank you. You're on now, right?
Yes. Good afternoon. I hope you're still awake. My task this afternoon is to address two of the six goals, and they are right here for you. Goal 4 speaks to the need for creating strategic alliances and partnerships to conduct transnational research. Goal 5 talks about the need for development and implementation of new social networking techniques. I am going to start off with goal 4 right away, and why I think this is important for us here in the U.S. By 2030, by some estimates, and most definitely by 2050, there will be a majority population that is immigrant. We've got to begin to plan around how we will service them. Immigration is often viewed as a total mass of people coming in. The truth is that from some countries, specific countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, immigration is gendered. And let me explain what I mean by that. For some women, it is easier for them to come first and later reunite their families. Why is that? Because many of the jobs available are for nannies, caretakers of older people, housekeepers. I mean, people have lost political careers or potential political careers for having hired illegal immigrants. We don't need to go into that. But I will say that those are low-paying jobs. They're not higher up in the economic strata. But those women still manage to support a remittance economy back at home and later reunite their families. But also what is important for us to consider is that immigrants, whether it is the women who come in to do the service jobs or the men who come in as migrant farm workers, after they have been here for a while, until they're able to reunite their families, they live transnationally. I know people who will take that absolutely dangerous route of going by land through Mexico back to Central America if a grandmother dies or somebody's very sick. There's a whole route of migration and a whole life of immigrants the average American doesn't understand. It doesn't know anything about. But I can take you to these immigrant communities along the eastern seaboard. And what transnational living speaks to is the fact that wherever people come from, they have their own community of people right here in the United States. Because you see, migration is selective. Not everybody who wants to come can come. You have to have a social contact here, somebody who will receive you, somebody who will connect you to a job, somebody who will give you somewhere to live until you can get on your feet, somebody who will feed you, who will buy you your first coat when winter hits, okay? It's highly selective. We have got to begin to do research on what are the medical systems people are leaving and coming from. What is the healthcare status there? And how that works out once they come here. This is very important. We also have a new phenomenon, which is that many U.S. residents also are now living transnationally. Anybody ready for a Caribbean vacation come January? We do that. And there are certain parts of Latin America and the Caribbean that are now preferred places for retirement than locations in the United States because you can no longer maintain the same lifestyle after you're retired here in the United States, but you can certainly do it in a lower income developing country. Now, my critique is probably more of a dialogue that I would love to have with NIH, because I do believe that some of our major scientific institutions, such as NIH and CDC, have already established a global focus. But they're certainly not doing it with a gender. And therein lies the problem. There are lots of challenges with developing an ability to do transnational research. But I believe the biggest hurdle is that there are unreliable data collection systems throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. They just don't maintain an accurate system for collecting data. And they don't maintain registries that are routinely utilized to report infectious diseases the way we do here. And even here, we sometimes will get undercounts and underreportings the way CDC did a few years ago in terms of the incidence of HIV/AIDS. So we tout it, we practice it, we still have problems. Imagine countries where those systems are not even in place. So, if we were to look at international bodies, such as the United Nations, what you will find is a tremendous amount of support for transnational research if you focus only on their Millennium Development Goals. Two or three of them speak directly to the need to focus on women. The education of girls, maternal child health, so that there is enough support for us here in the U.S. to begin to look at those populations of people that are going to come anyway, and that are here already, and that we need to begin to understand. Some developing nations are making an effort, but I have to tell you, the progress is slow, because their main cry is that they simply don't have the resources to do it. Now, if we look at goal number four, the major emphasis of goal number four is to create strategic alliances, and I want to suggest that that can be done in three ways. Number one, I think we're going to have to work with developing nations to establish reliable data collection systems. It is in our interest to understand what people are coming from here so that we can know how to deal with it because they're here. Number two, we have already begun, at least I live in New York City, so I can tell you that in New York City we've already begun to fine-tune our ability to disaggregate data so that we can readily extrapolate data on immigrant subgroups within the total U.S. population. And let me tell you why this is important. It is important because in New York, having had the ability to disaggregate the data by mother's country of origin, we were able to use that to twist the arms of the city council to get some more money to fuel our our infant mortality reduction program that we presented on this morning early. And how did we do that? Because once we started to look at infant mortality, we disaggregated the data by mother's country of origin, and what we found is that, yes, in New York City, we were able to bring down infant mortality to about 5.3 per thousand births. However, it was still at about 12 per thousand births for black babies and about 9.7 for Latino babies. And when we looked at where the people came from, it was fascinating. There were about seven to nine countries. Where the kids who died before their first year of birth, where their mothers came from. And it was two countries in Africa and five in Latin America and the Caribbean. There is a value in disaggregating the data because now you can put your resources into the communities where that is needed, because immigrants tend to live in communities where there are other immigrants, where they have resources and a network, a social network, to support themselves. And we were able to do that in New York. We also, and this is the third thing, we must begin to better use existing collaborations between U.S.-based agencies. I just completed a project, and I'll tell you about it in a minute. But in all of these countries, there is a presence from CDC, USAID, OAS, NIH, and they have global partners such as World Health, Pan American Health Organization, United Nations, World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank. And what we can begin to do is develop better partnerships with those people to get the kinds of transnational data that we will need to improve providing services to our immigrant communities. And let me show you how that worked out. I just completed a project called Conversemos on it was a pilot study of a multi-component transnational HIV/AIDS prevention project. We started out in three countries. We had to shut down our operations in Honduras when the president got deposed. But we stayed in Panama. We stayed in the Dominican Republic. And then we worked in the Dominican community in New York City, in Washington Heights, and the Panamanian community in Brooklyn, because they're distinct communities, as I've said before. So if you're working with Panamanians in Panama, you know where the Panamanians are in New York City. If you're working with Dominicans in Dominican Republic, you know where they are in New York City. And we ended up serving, initially we wanted to serve 400, we ended up serving a total of about 283 people over a three-month period. The analysis of that data is fascinating because, and I'm only giving you a partial listing here of some of what we found, but I must tell you that the greatest significance was mind-boggling in the sense that it was a short period of time. We were able to move people in terms of knowledge. We were able to move people in terms of stigma and condom use. And I must tell you that in Latin countries, the stigma, the level of stigma throughout Latin America and the Caribbean against AIDS is so high that it prevents people from getting care. They just don't access care. The culture, men who have sex with men will also have a wife and a couple of girlfriends to dispel any idea that he's gay. Okay? Because God forbid that he should come out and be a gay man openly, he pays a price. And there are countries in the Caribbean in which he can get killed. And it's legally sanctioned by government. Okay? Men will tell you, I am not gay because I do the penetrating. But you're having sex with a man. Yes, but I'm not gay. You're laughing, but this is the level of denial and the amount of stigma that people fear that will prevent them. So when you got people to move from saying that anybody with HIV should never care for their children or you never should hire somebody with HIV, that kind of a pre to post movement was highly significant. The concept of woman in many of the countries of the Caribbean is still a saint or a whore. So if a woman wants to use condoms, she must be sleeping around. It couldn't be to protect herself from. So if you propose that, okay, these are cultures in which women do not initiate discussions about sex. There's no opening for you to do that, and you do that at your own peril. You can get physically beaten. And we don't have time to touch domestic violence. But let me say this. Accusations of unfaithfulness is not a place you want to be, because your own mother won't support you if you're considered to be unfaithful. The program in Dominican Republic was wildly successful. That's just a picture of the graduation ceremony. The entire community in the village came out. It was absolutely a moment of movement for a lot of the people living there, not just women, but men as well, because the incidence of HIV is quite high in the Dominican Republic. Goal number five speaks to new social networking techniques. And I must tell you that it's not easy to do this kind of work in communities with very stringent cultures. We had to meet with community leaders, formal and informal, and get their buy-in and almost their entree and their introduction to obtain community participation. Because, you know, you just can't, anywhere, you can't walk into somebody else's community and say what? Here I am, I'm here to what? You know, the three great truisms in American society. One is the check is in the mail. The other one is, I'm going to marry you as soon as I can get a divorce from my wife. And the third one is, I am from the university, and I'm here to help you. People don't buy that always, okay? And so we really had to spend quite a bit of time on the ground, negotiating relationships, building relationships. And everywhere it took across a multi-sectorial approach. Apart from community in New York City, I had the good fortune of having been a founding member of a community-based organization, and they provided a lot of the support, Caribbean Women's Health Association. We worked with hospitals, we worked with nearby clinics. In Panama, we were able to get support from the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Education, and the Ministry of Social Development, as well as local CBOs. But again, it was building relationships one-on-one. In the Dominican Republic, there's one clinic that really worked with us, and they almost specialize in serving, in terms of the question that was asked over here, LGBT communities. It specializes in working with transsexual women and all of their health problems that grow out of living transsexual lives. But the value of all that work was that you had now a whole social network that was participating on different levels to make this happen. The social network that we developed to implement this program were based on two critical activities. It was the residents, and for them, what was important is that they then were connected to staff at clinics and hospitals and community-based organizations that they did not know before, and staff from those agencies participated in the conversation training curriculum. And so now they had a personal connection to somebody they could actually call and say, I want to get tested, but I don't want everybody to know. I want to come in for a routine or a cold, and it worked a lot better. And we did get quite a number of people tested. Program participants for me included not just the residents, however, and the agency staff, but it included the fact that we trained people in agencies that are there, that were existing before we got there, to deliver prevention and health promotion messages around HIV/AIDS to their whole constituency, not just the program participants, which meant that there was some sustainability built into this, that after we were gone, they would continue to provide prevention messages and risk reduction messages to their people. I want to end with some policy recommendations, because both goals 4 and 5 strongly suggest that we begin to provide support to conduct focused research on health disparities among immigrant women of color living not just here in the United States, but in their home countries as well, because they end up here. And I want to leave you with some words stated by Dr. Collins, head of NIH, who recently spoke of 5 key themes to be done, to the work being done at NIH. The 4th one mentioned is a greater emphasis on global health. We no longer live in our little village in the United States. We are part of a global community. Thank you very much for listening.
So some questions specifically for the last speaker, and then we should open it up to the whole panel. Okay?
Does this mean NIH is now willing to fund projects in other countries?
Not. And I'm not willing to go that far. No, I would probably want to defer to my colleague from NIH and say, what chances do we have to get transnational projects funded?
Well, I know that, let me just start by saying that this is the Women's Health Research Agenda, and these are new areas that we're trying to encourage the NIH in general to expand into. But historically, the NIH has funded research overseas, primarily through medical institutions and research organizations in the U.S., and then encouraging them to partner with communities or researchers in countries outside of the U.S. That has primarily been how the funding stream has gone. I do know that those researchers have then gone and tried to do some research infrastructure building to build capacity among researchers. Some researchers have gone on and done research in countries on their own, but historically I would say the NIH has funded through the American, you know, the U.S.-based medical institution.
I know Mark, in public health, they won't fund any interventions. They won't fund intervention research.
Well, primarily, there are interventions that are being funded by the NIH. Are you talking about public health interventions specifically?
Yes.
They usually look to the CDC to fund public health interventions, what they're calling these DEMIs, demonstrated evidence-based interventions. Primarily, they would look to the CDC to do that. And the CDC, as Dr. Bain-Smith had said, also has a global presence. And this is why I think the NIH is really calling for a re-look and reimagining of how we can build these strategic alliances to think differently. Because even in the in communities I know in Africa, they have been really trying to push the envelope and to see how they could be funded more directly.
I think it's still new, and I think that to the extent to which we push, and this is why we're here presenting today, we're all saying things that are new. Changing medical education, that's revolutionary. Changing the way NIH funds international projects, that's heresy. You could get your head lopped off. But I seriously believe... Close. But you know, I seriously believe, though, that
if we continue to do what we've always done, then we will continue to undermine the health of women, both
right
here in the U.S. and globally. So we have to think out of the box.
Yes.
And I think I appreciate you revisiting and saying this is what we've done in the past, but we're here to talk about what the future needs to be.
No, my question was, are they willing?
I would say that we would
yet
have to ask that question.
Right. I think we have to push the envelope. You have to go to them and say, this is what's needed.
Right.
We need to do it. And push and get them at least involved in a dialogue.
I just wanted to add to that. It's that although there's a lot of work done globally by a lot of these organizations and institutions, I think one of the things we need to think about, particularly as women advocates, and I think with the advocacy for women is now at a low ebb, and there's a lot of work to rebuild on that. But I think that the historical focus on disease versus gender is a very important thing to think about. So HIV is a big problem, then we discover, women are the highest, being infected the highest. So it's a byproduct of something else. And so to think about gender in a different way is going to mean a whole revolutionary changing of how you think about things. And I think what Marcia is talking about is not only about gender, but about people of color, about people of global identities, about race, about nationality. And those are, those are not white male issues. And they still rule, they're just ruled, white men just rule.
Mm-hmm. Just to add to that, last year I heard about interventions funded by NIH in other countries.
Really?
Yes.
There are some, but small.
And I would say HIV is probably going to be your one of those areas where you're going to find a significant amount of funding outside of the U.S. because the global, the epidemic is so high in the global south.
And USAID certainly does.
Absolutely.
However, there is, as far as I know, there is no clear focus on countries where women came from to the US.
Right, and we need to begin to think, and that's a fundamental premise of my talk today. We need to begin to think about that. Once again, I thank you.
Any other general questions? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Caroline Sparks. I'm at GW now, but I was at Ohio State years ago.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm from Michigan, okay.
Are you? The only time I was ever at the stadium was to fly a plane around that said OSU, dragging a banner that said OSU, what about women? And we got the women's studies program. For those of you that are doing dissertation work, don't think that you can't do unusual things. The woman I used to teach women's sexuality with, her name is Patricia Zinheim, go to dissertation abstracts. She did for her dissertation
comments? I have one. I mean, I was wondering both from the academic standpoint as well as the community standpoint how issues of access sort of reduce the possibility for us to do some of the things that you were both talking about. For example, in terms of women from other countries living here as immigrants, you know, issues, if documented and sometimes if not documented and sometimes if documented, health access is very, very reduced. So that what the government would pay for to do research sort of is not maybe the research that the women that you spoke so eloquently about actually, what their needs are that have to be evaluated more. And then from, you know, the academic standpoint, the challenge, I think, for us is to, of course, rephrase the questions and the science, but at the same time ensure that the sort of high-quality, women-centered access is there. And how do you think in today's both financial, economic times, and political times, we should be best pushing ourselves to address these?
You know, the issue of access is serious, but it depends on the state you're in.
Mm-hmm.
We've done some interesting things in the state of New York, mm-hmm. which is to provide prenatal care.
Right.
It just makes better sense than to have to try to deal with defective children after they're born and keep them in a acute intensive neonatal care unit at $2,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we've pretty much crossed that hurdle. The difficulty is that for a lot of researchers, they want a well-funded study with a large N. And I have no problem doing smaller studies. And I will tell you, when we started Caribbean Women's Health Association in 1983, it was because there were two small studies done by a colleague of mine who was at SUNY Downstate at the time, and she said, why is it that women with breast cancer or ovarian cancer who are black were dying in greater numbers from the disease than white women in Brooklyn? And lo and behold, it was because they were immigrant women. And that, we badgered, I'm dating myself, Mayor Koch, every twice a month we sent him a position paper, and we finally got a meeting and we walked in, and we said we're from the Caribbean Women's Association, and he said, oh God, don't send me another, right. Don't send me another white paper. What do you want? How much money do you want? And we sat down, we were able to negotiate with him to get our first infusion of dollars to start the organization. But you have to be willing to be where you are, do the research that, start where you are. Do the research. Look, there are immigrant communities in every state right now. Gateway City used to be the Northeastern Seaboard. Guess what? You have a huge population of Mexicans in North Carolina.